right. Can I have your attention? Can I have your attention? Going to call to order the first general session of the fall convention of 2006 for the California Council of the Blind. Is everybody having a good time?
Yeah.
Yeah. You have no complaints?
Yeah.
No, of course you do, but we don't want to hear them right now. That's right. Okay. To begin the proceedings, we're going to have one of our own from Orange County for the Pledge of Allegiance, Miss Coletta Davis.
Thank you, Mr. President. Okay. Shall we all rise? Put our hands over our hearts and let's all say the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Our invocation today will be given to us by Maurice Arterberry from the Apostolic Faith Church in Los Angeles. Mr. Arterberry?
All right. Good evening, everyone. We're going to bow our heads right now. Father God, in Jesus' name, we come to you in the name of Jesus, Lord. We thank you for this gathering. We thank you for these, your people, Lord. We thank you for our president here, Lord, of this convention. We ask you to bless, Lord, the endeavors, Lord, the business that they have to entail, oh God. The things they endeavor to do, we pray that you will smile on it and bless, oh God. Above all, Lord, give insight to seeking you and acknowledging you, Lord, for you are the source of all things, Lord. Hallelujah, to whom we have to do. We ask you to bless them now, Lord God. Bless the business. Bless these that are here, Lord God. Strengthen them from the crown of their heads to the sole of their very feet. We give you praise. We give you thanks, Lord. And we thank you for it now as they go further in their business area, Lord. We give you praise for giving them understanding, Lord, and they're in dealing in their objectives that they're about to reach. We'll give you praise and give you thanks for it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Arterberry. Our first presenter needs no introduction, and I'm not going to waste her time on a long one. Linda Dardarian is one half of the greatest legal team on this planet as far as we're concerned. Linda is a joy to work with, one of the greatest pleasures of having been president as far as I am concerned is working with Lainey and Linda, and without any further introduction, I'll turn it over to Linda to tell us about what's going on with respect to some of the structured negotiations on behalf of CCB. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff, for that wonderful introduction. And I have to say that for both Lainey and myself, the true joys of our careers has been the work that we've been doing with the CCB for the past 11 years. It's really been tremendous how we together with, you know, all of you, the members, the officers of CCB, and also some of the other ACB affiliates and the ACB, have worked to really change the way industry is done in this country. What I'm going to talk about today is some of the ongoing projects we have with the CCB on what we call structured negotiations. And structured negotiations is an alternative to litigation. And we've been using this process of structured negotiations for the past 11 years to focus on solving access issues for the blind community on technology primarily. The main focus of our initial efforts with the CCB was to get financial institutions to make their ATMs talk. And through the structured negotiations process, we approached Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual, Union Bank, and many other banks across the country. And instead of filing a lawsuit, which leads to distrust and animosity, we decided to enter into a more collaborative process where we explained what access, what accessible technology blind customers of the banks needed, and invited the banks, their representatives, their counsel, their business people, and their technology engineers to meet with us to talk about these issues, what the needs of blind customers are, and how their needs could be met through accessible technology. And those efforts have resulted in national binding legal agreements between Bank of America, Citibank, Wells Fargo, Washington Mutual, and many others, and the CCB that require the banks to have at least one talking ATM at every banking location in the United States, to have their websites comply with the priorities 1 and 2 of the worldwide web content accessibility guidelines, and to have comprehensive policies and procedures for providing alternative formats for written materials, including Braille, large print, and audio, and other electronic accessible electronic formats. You did that. You made the industry change. You did that in a collaborative way without ever having to file a single lawsuit, and it's really a credit to the CCB members that all of this has been done in a very supportive and positive way rather than having to file lawsuits. We never had to file a lawsuit. We would have if any of the banks told us to take a hike, that they weren't interested in talking to us, then we would have filed lawsuits. But none of them did. They were all interested in solving the problems of their customers. So what we're doing now, the last couple of years, a big focus of ours has been on point-of-sale machines at major retail chains. I'm sure you all remember back, you know, a few years ago, you could go to a check stand at a grocery store and enter your PIN number yourselves on a tactile keypad. And then about a couple years ago, retail chains started switching out the old tactile machines with flat screen point of sale machines that are basically just a flat piece of plastic or a flat piece of glass that you can't, that has nothing, no tactile aspect to it. So you can no longer enter your PIN numbers independently if you want to use your ATM card to make purchases at a grocery store. So we heard a lot of complaints from CCB members about Trader Joe's and Safeway in particular. So we invited Trader Joe's and Safeway to enter into structured negotiations with the CCB to find a solution that returned tactile keypads to the point of sale machines. And soon that effort expanded. We also invited Walmart to negotiate with us because we figured Walmart's the biggest company in the world, and if anyone could pressure manufacturers to change their technology, it would be Walmart. And then eventually we also began negotiations with Target, CVS Pharmacy, Rite Aid, 7-Eleven, and Radio Shack. And currently the CCB has settlement agreements, binding legal settlement agreements with Walmart, Safeway, and Trader Joe's, and are continuing to negotiate with all of these other retail companies for installations of tactile point-of-sale machines at all of their locations nationwide. Under the settlement agreement with Walmart, thank you, but it, really, you guys have done this. applause to everyone in the room. Under the Walmart agreement, Walmart has installed three tactile point-of-sale machines at staffed aisles in every store in the country. And the tactile point-of-sale machines have a telephone keypad layout for the number keys, a raised dot on the five, and tactile function keys to the in a column to the right of all the number keys, so that customers can input their PIN numbers, input the amount of cash they want to get back if they want cash back from their transaction. They can select the cash back function and can submit the data independently. Those machines are supposed to be located at the express lane nearest the main entry to the Walmart, at the middle front end check stand where the tobacco products are sold, because that's the aisle that stays open the longest amount of hours that the store is open, and also at the pharmacy counter. Within less than 3 years, 90% of all the staff checkout aisles at Walmarts will have tactile point-of-sale machines, so that you won't need to ask a clerk or the customer service staff where the tactile machine is. Virtually all of the aisles will have them, but under the legal agreement, we gave them a little exception because they will meet it, but they just couldn't commit to it. The other aspect of the Walmart agreement that's very exciting is that they're obligated to meet with CCB representatives once a year to talk about not only the implementation of the tactile point of sale machines and customer service issues, but on any other technology issue that affects Walmart's blind or visually impaired customers. That's a huge, huge benefit. To have direct access to the largest company in the world, they're committed to meet with us at least once a year to talk about any issue that concerns the blindness community regarding technology. We are trying, Lainey and I are trying to set up that meeting with Walmart in November, the week before Thanksgiving. So we're looking for, you know, volunteers to, you know, either to participate in the meeting, it'll probably be in the Bay Area, or at least to call us or email us with ideas or issues that you have with Walmart so that we can have a really fruitful discussion with them when we meet next month. The Safeway settlement agreement also requires installation of tactile point-of-sale machines at at least three aisles in each Safeway store. And they are all supposed to be in, the three tactile point-of-sale machines per store are supposed to be in already in California. That happened at the end of September. So you should be able to go to any Safeway store in California and be directed to a tactile point-of-sale machine. Because the agreement was just implemented, customer service staff are still having some issues with the training sort of sinking in. So if you go to a Safeway and you have a problem with the customer service staff not knowing that they have the tactile machines or where the tactile machines are located, please let us know, because we're communicating with Safeway's lawyer about the effectiveness of the implementation of the agreement. But also, if you have, you know, a good experience, we'd also be interested in hearing about that as well, because they always like to hear the good in addition to the bad. The installations are currently in the stores in California. There will be three point of sale machines in each Safeway store nationwide by June of next year. And then at the end of next year, Safeway is going to start meeting with us to discuss and test a further solution for all of their aisles in every store in the United States. Under the Trader Joe's settlement agreement, Trader Joe's will be installing tactile point-of-sale machines at one-third of every aisle in every Trader Joe's store in the country by the end of March 2007, and we will negotiate with Trader Joe's further in the middle of next year to get a full-scale rollout to all aisles in the country. And we're continuing to talk with Rite Aid, Target, Radio Shack, CVS, and 7-Eleven, and we hope to have agreements with them next year that provide for a comprehensive rollout of tactile point-of-sale machines at all of their aisles in every store in the country as well. But again, we're always invited to participate in testing of any technological solution that the retailers are trying. So we look forward and we welcome anyone who's interested to participate in the testing. So if you are interested, please let either Lainey or me or my assistant Scott Grimes know. Another area that we're very active in is web access, and already CCB has, without ever filing a lawsuit, negotiated binding legal agreements with Bank of America, Union Bank, and Washington Mutual that require their websites to be accessible to people with visual impairments. We're currently in negotiations with Rite Aid and Radio Shack to make their websites accessible. And in fact, Rite Aid recently, you may have read about this on through email, but Rite Aid just rolled out what they believe is a new website, their new website that's supposed to comply with priorities 1 and 2 of the W3C guidelines. So please try it out if you can and let us know what you think of, because we, again, we have the opportunity to provide Rite Aid with any feedback that we have about the accessibility of their new website. So please let us know. We're also in negotiations with the three credit reporting agencies, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, on web access and accessibility of their printed materials. This issue first came up when CCB members learned that the three credit reporting agencies were ordered by the federal government to set up a system where people can get at least one free copy of their credit report every year. And what the agencies did was they set up a website where you can order your credit report that is either provided online or they'll mail a hard copy to you for free. The problem is the website's not accessible. And they also provided a toll-free number to get a hard copy, but the credit reports through the toll-free number are only available in standard print. They did not provide alternative formats. So in our negotiations with the three credit reporting agencies, what we're seeking is to make the website where you can order your credit report accessible, make the each page of the website that leads to the order form accessible, make the credit reports that customers can view online accessible, and to provide alternative formats, including Braille, large print, audio, and electronic formats for the hard copy credit reports and other printed materials that they make available to their customers. And those negotiations are ongoing in good faith. Many of you have been involved in that effort as well, which we so appreciate, and the credit agencies appreciate as well. And we hope to have an agreement to announce on those issues next year. We're also continuing to work on other companies for alternative formats. So if at this point in time, the blind community should be able to expect that they have the right, that you have the right, to effective communication of printed materials that public accommodations provide. So if there are companies that you do business with that are not providing effective communication, please let Lainey and me know about that as well. Another issue that we've been addressing through structured negotiations is audible pedestrian signals in the city of San Francisco, which we'll be talking about more later at the 3 o'clock session, so I won't go into that now. If you're interested, you have to come to the 3 o'clock session. Something that we have that we want to get started working on with everybody here is the issue of audible prescriptions. And because we are in negotiations already with many of the major pharmacy chains in the country, we'd like to approach those companies on the issue of audible prescription labeling, because we believe that it's your Title III right to full and equal enjoyment of the goods and services of these pharmacies to have effective communication of your prescription information. So if you're particularly interested in that issue, you should also let Lainey and me know. And we've recently heard some complaints from CCB and ACB members that have applied for employment through NTI and Alpine Access, that here's this organization that exists to employ people with disabilities, and yet they categorically exclude people with visual impairments. So if you have experience with applying for NTI or Alpine Access and being rejected for a job, please, please, please let us know. Those are both audible prescriptions and NTI are top priorities. So, and again, if you have any other complaints against regarding point-of-sale machines by national chains, for alternative formats or accessible websites, please let me and Lainey know. I should give you our contact information if you don't already have it, or maybe we can have it posted on the CCB website or through an 800 number. But my firm has an 800 number. I'm not sure what the best way is to get that information to all of you right here. What do you think, Jeff?
Go ahead and give it, and then we'll also put it in the...
Okay, great. So my firm's 800 number is 1-800-822-5000. That's a toll-free number, 800-822-5000. We also have an email box. It's info, I-N-F-O, at G as in good, D as in dog, B as in boy, legal.com. Info at GDBlegal.com. And Lainey is at 510-548-5062. And her email address is lfeingold1@earthlink.net. And Feingold is spelled F-E-I-N-G-O-L-D.
Okay, we do have time, excuse me, for a couple questions. And the mic is up in the front, so if you can head toward the front, and someone will assist you to... You should always have your cane on your hat, person.
I know. It's Mitch.
Oh, hi, Mitch.
I have been sort of spearheading the NTI effort nationally for the last couple of years, and I'm so happy that you folks are taking a serious interest. I exchanged emails with Lainey on Monday. On Tuesday, I put together the list of names that I have gathered over the past 2 years of individuals who were the apparent victims of discrimination by the National Telecommuting Institute, and I made a hard copy because I didn't have it in electronic format, and I put that in the mail to you Wednesday morning, so hopefully you should have it in your office by now.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks, Mitch. That's great.
You're welcome.
Yeah, and really, again, this is another example of community effort and, you know, grassroots organizing that gets tremendous results.
Do we have any other questions?
Yes.
There's a whole bunch.
Okay, yeah.
Yes. What I was wondering, is there any way that when you use the department store, credit card, or the grocery store, if they could have a uniform way where you put the credit card in, and sometimes they say swipe it to the right or left or down or up, so the metal part of the credit card will, you know, be the same uniform way, because you have to say, which way do you want it?
Right.
And also when you sign, depending in the department store, I believe Radio Shack or certain places, they have the metal signature, kind of like a signature guide, and the strip of paper comes out that way. And some of the department stores will have the little block of the electronic signature.
Right.
And if there's some way they could put a little, somewhat of a metal guide or something where you know where to place it.
Right.
Because it can be frustrating. Now, one thing that they had long ago in the old Hughes grocery stores, and a lot of regular seniors who are not with CCB, like this, is that they had a scanner where you could look down on the table when the groceries were coming by, and you could see, they had this screen up above, and you could see your prices, but they had it down below where you could look down, and you could even see your prices, and it was in large letters.
Oh, really?
And it would say $4.95 or so forth. And now when they look and say, they want you to look at the price and see the total, and you said, excuse me? And, you know, you could see something, but you can't really see what the cost of everything is or your total. And you have to ask, where before it was to the point where you could look down and you could see how much your cost of your grocery bill would be, because the letters were very large.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of uniformity, unfortunately, the only thing that we can get uniformity on is the layout of the number keys, mm-hmm. the raised dot on the 5, and the tactile symbols on the function keys. Where they swipe or which direction mm-hmm. the card is swiped, that's up to the store. There's no, you know, there's nothing that we can... There's no basis in the law for requiring them to be uniform on that feature. The companies that we're negotiating with and that we have agreements with for credit card signatures, mm-hmm. the signature line is at the bottom of the screen, so mm-hmm. you can use the screen surround as a tactile guide. Mm-hmm. And they're also, the clerks are supposed to provide the alternative of signing on a piece of paper. You're not required to sign on the screen anymore at Walmart, Trader Joe's, or Safeway. And we're also, that's one of the requirements of our negotiations with the other retailers as well.
But like I was saying, that's good there, but sometimes the department stores, you have the little electronic pad. Like sometimes with UPS, you have the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you may be able to put your finger down and, you know, figure the lower part of the screen or whatever.
I guess we have more targets then.
Yeah.
The department,
like Penny's,
the department stores. Yeah.
Okay, we don't have too much more time, so we're going to have to go on to the next.
Oh, okay.
Next question.
Hi, Linda. This is Donna Seliger from Iowa.
Hi, Donna. Welcome to California.
Well, thank you. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Have you considered looking into the McDonald's point-of-sale machines?
No, but that's a great idea.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, next person.
Very quick question for Linda. Down here, the Safeways are Vons. Are they included in this settlement agreement?
Yes, every chain that's part of the what they call the Safeway family is included, and that would include Vons and all of them. Everything that Safeway's bought up over the last few years is included.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome.
Hi, Linda. This is Gabe Griffith.
Hi, Gabe.
I just had a quick question about, well, maybe not quick, hopefully quick, about Safeway and their website. I'm not sure, or I guess all of them, where you can do online shopping,
such as
Safeway, Albertsons, if they still do that. I'm not sure about the regular website, but I know they have, for instance, Safeway has an accessible website that you can go to, and the items that are on sale have a link where you can click, and it gives you the information about how much you're selling or saving, what the normal price would be. Is there any chance, or would you think that it would even be a good idea or bad idea to try and approach these stores about putting a feature on there where when there's an item up on that site, you can have a link that you can click on to get information such as the nutritional information, cooking information?
If they provide that already for sighted customers, then that should definitely be accessible.
Okay, and I'm not sure if it is accessible.
Yeah, sorry I forgot to mention the Safeway website. We have received a number of complaints from CCB members over the last year or so about the Safeway website and the difficulty or the impossibility of checking out through the online shopping, so we do plan on approaching Safeway on that issue.
Yeah, and like I said, I'm not even sure on the regular site if they have any of that information.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just wanting to see if it would be something that would even be worth looking into.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, we have two more people, and that's going to have to do it, or else so we can go on to our next presenters.
Peter Shellen from San Luis Obispo. Is the United States Post Office on your list?
You know, it's on the point of sale issue or on other issues?
Point of sale.
From what we've found, the Post Office recently has started installing tactile point of sale machines. And what they have is an ancillary device that has the tactile keypad on it, and they plug it into the main or flat screen point of sale machine. And I'm not sure if that's available in all post office locations yet or what their schedule is for installing them, but at least the ones in Berkeley and Oakland that we've found, they do have tactile point of sale machines now at the
But you don't know how soon they'll go to the smaller cities.
I don't know. Post office is definitely on our list. We need to do further investigation into how widespread their rollout of tactile machines is. And I thank you, Peter, for bringing that up.
Thank you.
It's 10 after 2. Should we keep going?
Hi, this is Dave Jackson.
Hi, Dave.
Have you approached Walgreens regarding the talking bottles?
Regarding the talking bottles, we haven't, but they're the only reason why we haven't is because we're not in negotiations with them on the point of sale, and the reason why we're not in negotiations with them on the point of sale is because they do have tactile point of sale machines. But that doesn't mean that Walgreens is not a good idea as another possibility to explore.
Linda?
Yeah, hi, Barbara.
Barbara Rose, Walgreens is doing a beta test of the talking bottles.
Did everybody hear that? Barbara says that Walgreens is doing a beta test of the talking pill bottles in Chicago. Great.
All right. Let's hear it for Linda and all the great work. Okay. What a way
so
to start
much,
off. Thank you. We'll hear her again.
Thank all of you for your great ideas and your wonderful contributions. We look forward to much, much more success in the future.
Okay, our next presentation I am extremely anxious to hear. Self-driving cars, curse or blessings? This, yes indeed, this is going to be great, I have a feeling. We have two presenters, I'm going to introduce them one at a time, and then we'll save questions for after our second presenter. Sebastian Thrun is an associate professor of computer science and electrical engineering at Stanford University, where he also serves as the director of the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. His research focuses on robotics and artificial intelligence. He's delivered numerous invited plenary presentations and won a number of awards. He also served as the inaugural General Conference Chair of Robotics Science and Systems 2005, as well as General Conference Chair of Neural Information Processing Systems 2003, and Conference on Automated Learning and Discovery 1998. I don't even know what any of that means that I just read. That's so this far beyond me. I am extremely honored to present to you Sebastian Thrun.
Well, good afternoon. Let's see if this is working. Can you hear me? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. It's a great honor and privilege to be here today. I want to thank Jeff, Tom for inviting me, and Gene, who's unfortunately, I guess, not here today. And also Brian Higgins, who's sitting next to me, who's been following this field for many years, and will address you when I'm done. So the faster I speak, the more time Brian will have. I come to you as a scientist representing Stanford University, working in the field of intelligent vehicles, but also as a citizen who cares a lot about quality of life and all of us. That's why I'm particularly eager to take my time to talk to the CCB, because that's an important issue to me. My history is I grew up in Germany, got my various academic degrees in Germany, including a PhD, moved to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to teach at a college called Carnegie Mellon University, and then 3 years ago moved to Stanford University to enjoy San Francisco and the wonderful outdoors around Stanford. In my research, I look into questions, how can we make machines smarter in many ways. I've worked with robots that operate in museums as tour guides. I've built robots that operate in nursing homes and assist nursing staff. And most recently, I've explored robots on the roads that can transport people around, in other words, self-driving cars. The most recent event in my life that I guess made some people like Jeff and Gene kind of focus on us at Stanford is a race that took place last year in October called the DARPA Grand Challenge. So I hear some people have heard about this. I'm going to tell you some of the details of what happened. But before I do this, I want to give you a bit of an overview of the history of self-driving cars, car research. As we all know, the car is about 100 years old, and it requires, of course, human operation. For all of you, the idea of having cars drive themselves like trains makes perfect sense. But even for people who have never thought about this before, there's a number of reasons why we want to do this. The average American worker spends, on average, at least an hour per day in commute operating vehicles and losing that time effectively. And cars, mostly human failure to handle cars, cost this nation about 42,000 people a year. It's a huge number of people lost. It's about 15 times as many as September 11, in terms of number of lives we spare every year in this country. The self-driving car or mechanisms to make cars easier to operate and safer to operate by people, therefore has an enormous potential to save lives, improve quality of life for many people, especially, of course, the visually impaired, and also make people more productive. This has been recognized for many decades now, and in the late 80s, there were research agendas in the United States and in Germany and some in Japan to understand whether cars could drive themselves and what's required technologically to achieve that. In the early 90s, the United States began investing in this. By investing, I mean the government would disperse research funds to universities and small companies to build prototype versions. And a number of major players, including Carnegie Mellon University, came up with projects where cars would drive for short periods of time themselves. All these cars would be equipped with equipment to understand the environment, very often television-type cameras, and computers that would then make the decisions as to what direction to take and how fast to go. In a fairly spectacular experiment in the early 90s, a self-driving car drove itself, almost entirely itself, from Boston to Southern California, San Diego, with researchers from Carnegie Mellon University. Now, I want to quantify this a little bit so that you don't hold your hopes too high at this point. Inside this car, of course, was a person who was nervously watching his car making the right thing. And this was all on highways, it's entirely on highways. So the person would also just have the car take over the steering wheel and not the gas and throttle, so he could be a little bit safer. And at numerous occasions, the car would do something very stupid, and the person had to basically flip a switch and take over manually. That happened for about 1.5% of the total distance driven. But still, think about technological progress. That was a real milestone. Similar milestones were achieved in Germany, where Mercedes-Benz worked with the University of the Bundeswehr, which is the German army, and they showed autonomous or self-driving cars that could go 200 kilometers per hour. It's like 130 miles per hour, which, of course, in the United States is illegal. In Germany, you can go any speed that you like. Now, in 2001, the Congress actually appropriated a bill called the Future Combat Systems Act. And in that bill, it set a target for military vehicles in that by 2015 it wants to see a third of all ground vehicles, combat vehicles, be self-driven or driverless without a person inside. And the motivation for doing this is crystal clear. In conflict zones like Iraq, we lose a lot of our people by things like roadside bombs. If we could get people outside trucks, then we could save numerous lives. That goal was, of course, been set, and with it came a lot of funding almost $500 million for research on self-driving cars that mostly went to big defense contractors that eat it up and move slowly, in my opinion. Because of a relative lack of progress, and I think the best characterization in the early 2000s was that cars could drive maybe 2-3 miles themselves and then do something incredibly stupid that the person had to take over. So clearly not usable by anybody. The government, and specifically an agency called DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, issued a competition, and that's completely unique in the history of the United States. It's a competition to build a car that can drive itself for 150 miles without any human intervention. And I'm not talking about a remote-controlled car where you have a car that is connected to some other person over a wireless link and that person controls the car from a remote location. I'm talking about a car where you take the person out of the car and put a computer inside, and the computer makes all the decisions for 150 miles. The way this event was organized is that you could register, you would become a contestant, there would be a stepper which the government would select the 20 most likely teams that could succeed. And then 2 hours before this historical race, which took place early 2004, every team would get a CD with 2,700 breadcrumbs. These breadcrumbs essentially were GPS referenced location. And GPS, it can tell you where you are. So these 2,700 points together, they kind of defined a course that was 142 miles long. And that course was an off-road kind of course. It went, if you're familiar with California, if you go from here to Vegas, you hit Barstow. It started near Barstow and went north of I-15 all the way to Prim. Prim is a small city right across the border to Nevada. The specifications were such that you could win $1 million of tax money if you could only build a car that could go that specific course by itself without any human intervention whatsoever within 10 hours. 142 miles, 10 hours, seems to suggest you have to hit an average speed of 14.2 miles per hour. That was simple math. Now, in reality, this sounds very slow, so on a highway this is certainly very slow. In these kind of desert terrain, unpaved, kind of more like trail running, where you have very small roads with lots of ruts and cliffs and so on, that's actually quite a substantial speed. Now, that race became amazingly popular among the people because everybody understands the vision of how good it is to have a self-driving car, and among the scientists, because for us, this was an enormous challenge. There was really a quantum leap to be conquered, to go from cars that could only drive 2 or 3 miles to one that could actually drive 150 miles. That still is a small distance, but I mean, progress comes in steps, and for us scientists, this looked like a huge step. So some of the world's best researchers in the world got together and formed teams to compete in this competition. In March, I think 14, 2004, this first competition took place. And about 15 different teams were able to participate, had cars that could do that. And they were all of the same type. They would be mostly regular passenger cars, retrofitted so that a little motor could turn the steering wheel, so it wouldn't require a person anymore. And another little motor could actuate the brake and the gas pedal. And they were all connected to computers that would process data that the car would take about the environment. And they would all use these computers to make the decisions where to go and where to turn and so on. Now, unfortunately, the 2004 event was a bit of a disaster, just reminding us how difficult driving actually is and how smart people sometimes actually are in things that we think as very mundane tasks. Out of the 142 miles, no team made it further than 5%. Most cars got stuck within the first mile. In fact, some of the vehicles got stuck in the first 5 feet. And those who drove a little bit further would drive off the road, on the road. They had clearly no understanding what a road is. They would run into fence posts. They would push rocks around. And the best performing car, again by Carnegie Mellon University of Pittsburgh, had a big bumper. It ran into two fence posts and finally almost fell down a cliff, got high-centered, and burned up a rubber tire, which made for interesting visuals to see a car stuck in the desert, almost burning. The worldwide media, who had followed the event with great attention, condemned the outcome very quickly as, look, this is hard. And it was generally believed it would take years, maybe decades, for someone to win this competition. Now, nice thing about being at Stanford is there's no mountain too high for motivated young kids who just joined Stanford and who haven't yet read the scientific literature to understand how hard it is. So you can tell them, do that, and they do their very best to do that. So at Stanford, we decided after seeing this first disaster, we got to work on that. And we got to work on this because I think it's important for so many of all of us. Of course, first and foremost, all of you. And we got to work on this because it's a fantastic technological challenge. So DARPA, the agency, reissued the same competition to be taking place October 2005. Just my years here straight, right? Now it's 2006, okay. So October 2005, and they also doubled the prize money to $2 million to make it even more incentive. And that doubled actually the number of different groups that tried to build a car to 195 total. So in 2005, 195 different teams were out to compete. They included some of the very best universities in the country. They included some of the very best companies in the country. Ford was involved, Volkswagen was involved, automotive manufacturers. And they also included a lot of people who had neither a strong university nor a strong company behind them, but we called them car nuts. These are people who had a car and had a computer, and it was very imaginable that they could hook these two things together to make a self-driving car and win $2 million. The event itself came in all kinds of stages. The world media got really interested. To participate, you had to be able to demonstrate that your car could drive itself first for 200 yards, then for about 2.5 miles. And in that process, the organizers were able to down-select the number of contestants from about 195 all the way to 23 that were allowed to race. So on October 8th, 2005, 23 cars went out to start an historical race. And you got to picture this the following way. There's 23 teams with maybe 50 people per team hanging out in Prim in the Mojave Desert at 1 a.m. in the morning waiting for the secret race course to be revealed in form of yet another nearly 3,000 breadcrumbs. And they all have cryptic looking and sounding machines that are full of computers and whose roofs are look like from a different planet, full of sensors, and they've all been programmed to be able to drive any number of miles through the desert. At 4 o'clock in the morning, DARPA released to us the teams, and I was running the Stanford team obviously, the course in form of these 3,000 breadcrumbs. A course mostly through flat and mountainous terrain in the Mojave Desert, unpaved roads mostly. And 2 hours later, we had to bring our car, last time we actually drove it manually, to the starting line where they were turned into robots and had to go by themselves. Then at 6:30, the organizers would start the race, and they would start this in a staggered start. So every 5 minutes, a robot would get a starting signal. We had to push a button. And from that point on, the car would really drive itself. There was no person inside the car, and for good reason, because having a robot drive you through a desert is a dangerous endeavor. And there's many different ways a robot could fall on a cliff or burn up and kill somebody. But what it was a technology demonstration that that cars could actually do this. Now, for us it was strange because we've worked in this car. We spent months on end in this car and building it up, trying it out, seeing it fail, improving it, making it better technology. And this was the moment of truth where we had to go out of the car and the car had to not drive itself using only computers as its only way to make decisions. With us were 22 other teams to do the same thing. Now, the race itself was really, really interesting. The cars all started out very confidently and moved into the desert in 5 minutes intervals. And very quickly, within the first 30 minutes, they surpassed the 7 mile marker, which was the distance that's been driven in the previous race. So there was clearly progress. Clearly, the cars were more capable than the year before. But no one really knew whether to expect that any car could do it. The course itself was really challenging for even for humans to drive. It involved very narrow underpasses under I-15. It involved treacherous small mountain passes where any wrong decision would immediately fall, let the car fall down a cliff. It involved all kinds of other difficulties, ruts and berms that are really difficult to navigate even for people. So the cars went out, and through the course of a day, out of these 23 cars, 18 failed. They got stuck somewhere. They drove off the course. The failures often were of the type that there was a software bug, right? So the car would be able to drive 50 miles, but not 60. Or they were of the type that something in the car fell apart because the punishing desert terrain pounded these cars. For example, one team had a laptop strapped onto the roof of the car, and their laptop came loose, and with the loss of the laptop came a loss of any intelligence, so the car started driving blindly. But the good news was, 5 cars actually finished, and in fact, 4 of them finished in an amazingly short time. It was 130 miles down the race, and it took about just below 7 hours for the fastest car to finish. That makes an average speed of about 20 miles per hour. And you have to take my word for it. If you had been on this course, this is not a highway. You don't cruise. You work hard. It's basically skilled off-road driving. So Stanford won. We built a robot called Stanley. Thank you. And we got the check, which we use to support students now. And the fame and so on. We got a lot of media coverage. It was pretty much in every newspaper in the world. New York Times had many articles, Associated Press. It was a big thing for all of us in robotics. It's been described by New York Times as the most significant event in artificial intelligence, which is a scientific field, in the last 10 years. Now, there were many, many deficiencies of that race, and the most notable one was the desert is interesting maybe for military, but to bring this to people at large, you have to be able to drive in urban environments as well, where there's other traffic that you have to negotiate with and interact with. So DARPA just launched a new competition that will take place November 3rd, 2007. So if you're taking notes, put this in your calendar. November 3rd, 2007, where hopefully another 20 cars will drive about 60 miles in a city. Now, you might be concerned that if you go outside your door, that's your city. But what will likely happen is that the government will pick some abandoned army base that they can control so there's no pedestrians that these robots could accidentally run over. But they will interact at traffic intersections and so on, and they'll basically have to follow the rules of traffic. And they will be completely unmanned. That is, if you were to sit inside the car, you'd have to take zero action. You could fall asleep and wake up half an hour later and everything goes well. You'd still be alive and the car would do its thing. Basically run errands in a city. Before I finish, I want to say a few words because I think all of you passionately care about that and all of you are going to have the question, you know, when can I get that for myself? This is a long technology road, and I want to caution you to hold your hopes too high at this point and characterize where we stand. In the last 20 years, we went from cars that could drive half a mile to now cars that can drive 150 miles. And hopefully next year, we're going to have cars that can drive 150 miles in realistic traffic. That's our goal. 150 miles is a relatively short distance, to be honest. People can drive about 70 million miles before they have one fatal accident where they die in expectation. So if you look at the number of miles driven in this country and number of people or fatal accidents, you get about 1.5 fatal accidents per 100 million miles driven. So that means the reliability of the systems has to go up by a factor of about a million to be even, before we even can think about using them. That is not a trivial technology task. So while I think the vision of self-driving cars stand, I would be doing you a disfavor telling you that in 5 or 10 years we're going to have the system at a level where they're safe to operate. There's also legal implications. At present, in Europe at least, there's kind of the same as the supreme law of traffic, called Vienna Convention, that prohibits the operation of anything moving, anything motorized in public spaces without full control of a human driver. And that certainly limits the applicability of this technology from a legal perspective. There's all kinds of issues we have to work out on that end. And clearly there's a responsibility issue if someone sits in the car, be that person visually impaired or not, may the person is just asleep, say, and the car drives itself, what does it mean if the car gets into an accident? Who's going to pay the bill? Will it be the automotive manufacturers or will it be the person inside the car? Clearly, it will be the person inside the car, so we have to see the twist that the automotive manufacturers will play in the next decades on us to make that responsibility away from themselves and move for the person inside the car. But nevertheless, I think there's a fantastic vision for this country. This country has... I think it's built more on innovation than any other country in the world. And as you can hear from my accent, I'm German, so I came for this country for that reason. There's been so fundamental innovations in the last decades that we never dreamt of, like the internet, for example, that makes it possible to communicate with people all around the world. And I think the self-driving car, if it materializes and when it materializes, will be of no lesser impact. It'll really change our lives in such fundamental ways that it make transportation available for all of us at any time, and really make cars much, much safer. In the meantime, there will be a number of inventions that make existing cars easier to operate. These inventions are often called driver assistance systems. They come in form of cars that can regulate that speed automatically in accordance to a vehicle in front of them, so they keep kind of a fixed distance and they slow down if the car in front of them slows down. There's systems that are called lane departure warning systems that warn drivers when they're about to veer off a lane. And these systems are already commercially available. They're systems that park cars themselves. So right now you can buy a Lexus, and that Lexus has a facility whereby the car can park itself into a parking gap. So I think we're looking in the near term at a stream of technology that makes certainly cars safer. And I can't wait for the day where all of you will benefit from this technology. Thank you very much for
inviting me. Thank you. That's great. Let's... hopefully we'll have time for one or two questions. We are running a little late, but let's hear a few words from one of our members now, the Silicon Valley area, Brian Higgins, who is CEO of IntelliSite. Brian?
Thank you, Jeff. This is an exciting topic for me, and that's why I made the trip down. Sebastian, I think, has laid out the reality of where this is. I'm going to explain what I'm doing, and at the end, don't let me forget, I want to let you guys know what you can do now to make this technology a reality. But I know I've been researching this for quite a few years. You know, when I had to give up my driver's license, that was a big issue for me, and we all know transportation. Actually, how many people are here right now are happy with paratransit or the public transit systems or your independence based on transportation?
It's two people.
Two Race people. Time. Good,
three.
Good.
You guys from New York?
Or Europe.
What I'm trying to illustrate with that question is my motivation coming to Silicon Valley initially. As some of you know, ACB member Ashley, I've met a few of you people. I used to be the guy from Maine. So I said, hey, I'm really interested in this topic. A friend of mine gave me Carnegie Mellon East Alvin Project, which is what Sebastian had mentioned earlier, right after I lost my driver's license. So I don't know if he was trying to set the stage or, but it's basically my goal to be either catalyst or to research, and I've been learning everything that I can. Currently, I'm in a robotics organization that meets at Moffett Field, NASA, up in Mountain View. I've changed my whole vocation to become a blind rehab specialist. I'm currently working at the VA to learn everything that I can that translates into making this a reality. It's really exciting. I think there's a lot happening. And Sebastian mentioned the Lexus. So I think technically, right now, a blind person could park, a parallel park, a Lexus car, based on what we... Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of people that I work with in robotics are, you know, looking and saying that the autonomous vehicle is on the horizon.
Ask a quick question?
No.
Sure.
Oh. No, not till the end.
All right, so what can you do? I think one of the things that everyone can do, get really interested in the topic. I've been working hard, learning every aspect that I can, and I think you're doing it right now. We have so much technology coming on the road that's going to be, that does play a part in this overall technology that gives you an autonomous vehicle. How many people have Trekkers or Maestros or are thinking about trying to get their voc rehab or whoever to get one for them? I shouldn't say Trekker. GPS, how's that? You know, how many people have? And about mini guides or MOWAT sensors. Anyone heard of those? Yeah. Okay. These are all instruments that I started out putting on my bike. Oh, I forgot to mention, as part of starting my company, IntelliSight, and as part of moving to Silicon Valley, I figured what better place to make all this happen. Learning robotics, becoming a blind rehab specialist so I can come from that venue, that aspect. I'm also collecting data on a day-to-day basis by riding my bike to work back and forth. And I started out initially with a MOWAT sensor, a mini guide, and the Trekker as building my confidence. And I've developed other senses and other strategies but I'm basically, I feel I'm researching this, I'm collecting the data from a standpoint of someone who's blind and visually impaired. And so this is what I'm doing, and I think if everyone takes advantage of all this technology, which is being used in these vehicles, this will happen.
All right. Thank you very, very much, Brian. Okay, let's Jerry was first. I'm going to recognize Jerry for, we'll have one more question after his. Oh. No? Okay. Do we have any questions? I think, was that Kathy that did I hear?
Kathy and Mike.
Okay. Let Kathy hurt her first. Yes, we can.
Yes.
I have my questions for the first gentleman. In your deliberations and you're working on this project, which I think is wonderful, but, you know, I hear all about insurance and other things, and I wonder, are you looking out to see if your robot is good? How is it going to know when a person's in front of them so it doesn't go?
Okay, she asked essentially how the robot technology is going to know when a person is in front of them.
Katie, thanks very much for this excellent question. This is of course of key concern. In a desert you're likely not to face people, so you can just keep going. All you face is probably rabbits or smaller animals. In a city. This is of paramount concern for us. Now, I didn't go into detail about the technology behind these cars, and I'm going to give you one explanation that actually is a good explanation for avoiding or being safe in the presence of pedestrians or bicycles. These cars are equipped with sensors. that enable them to make measurements at a range of about 80 meters out, 80 yards out. And the way these sensors work, there's a lot of progress in the field. They send out infrared light. Infrared light gets reflected, very much like the sunlight gets reflected on the Earth. And then light comes back to the sensor, and the sensor can measure the distance to anything using these light measurements. That's a very new technology. It's called laser technology, or LIDAR, for laser information ranging and sensors. And it allows the robot to kind of get a almost like a three-dimensional picture of its surroundings. It knows where the buildings are and where the street curbs are and where the parked cars are and also where the pedestrians are. And a really big topic on my end in building these machines is to write then computer code that can take that data and make the robot make the right decision. So what I do is I write a computer program that analyzes the data. I ask, is there a pedestrian somewhere? Is the robot likely to collide with that pedestrian? And if so, what can we do in terms of steering, brake, and throttle to avoid that collision? That in itself is a wonderful research topic, and I think in the last 10, 15 years, everybody who worked on this has looked into that.
Okay, we had one other question. Mike, I believe?
Thank you.
Yes? Let's see if we can get Mike to a mic.
Well, Mike is coming up. If I could quickly add to Sebastian's comment, Kathy's question, the sensors that they're using is very sophisticated, but it's real similar to the ultrasonic sensor mini guide or the laser cane. So, I mean, there's on a very simplified scale, I mean, we're already using some of this technology.
Well, one of the things that is intriguing me isn't so much the fact that the technology is happening to build these systems, because that's just the way it is. That's what people do. But I think the more intriguing thing is, when it gets to be a point where it could work, how are we going to sell it to the people who don't want machines to be controlling their lives? I think that would be quite a challenge.
Brian, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, that's some of the areas I've been working on. I can give you a few examples. It is going to be a hard sell. I mean, I've been going to grant companies for the last 5 years saying, I want to put a blind person behind a car. Give me some money. And everyone can imagine, you know, how that went over. So actually, I'm scaling that back to get my funding. But some of the other areas, there is a lot of obstacles that's going to be in place. And I think the more we use this technology, the more the obstacles. A perfect example, where I work at the VA, the Blind Center, there's a tandem program. And I'm an excellent captain, which means you need somebody in the front of the tandem to give people rides on your tandem. I've given personal friends rides as the captain, but officially the VA will not let me captain a veteran or someone that's at the center. So, I mean, these are all obstacles. I'm competent in my skills and abilities, but the establishment, and the same thing with all this technology. MOAT sensors, that's what I wanted first before I wanted a white cane. And they said, oh, he's going to have to use a long white cane anyways. Get him into that and don't let him use this crazy technology. These are things that I continually come up against, and we've got to change the attitude about technology.
All right. Well, thank you very much, both of you. I guess I was just hoping, as a Stanford person, that Mr. Thrun could do something to help our football team with some technology. Yeah, that would be a miracle. You're right. Yeah, it would take one. All right. Well, this has been a great topic. Let's hear it again for our presenters. This is outstanding. And we'll certainly keep an eye on things, and maybe we can lure Mr. Thrun back in a couple of years to tell us how the next race went. So, all right.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to get, do we have our other presenter up here yet?
Yes.
Our next panel is entitled Blindness is Not an Adverse Selection. Now, our panelist today is Dominic Dardario from the Stonewitter Insurance Services Group. Okay. Dominic is licensed for the state of California in life and health insurance and fire and casualty insurance and certified by the state in long-term care insurance. Mr. Dardario is also a licensed registered representative of the Securities Exchange Commission and the National Association of Securities Dealers. Dominic is a published author and writer for the State of California Department of Insurance on property and casualty and life and health insurance instruction. He's also written and published instruction textbooks for the State of Nevada Department of Insurance. He's also licensed to teach the required pre-licensing courses for insurance instruction. Although this is a very fascinating topic, and without any further ado, let's hear from Dominic Dardario.
Well, thank you. You know, as I was sitting here listening to Sebastian's presentation, you ought to get that technology on all the vehicles, Sebastian, because even sighted people can't see where in the heck they're going. Well, I'm here to talk about adverse selection, and I'm here to talk to you about how it impacts or doesn't impact a blind person. And what I want to tell you is that all insurance companies, doesn't matter what kind of an insurance company they are, a health insurance company, a life insurance company, an auto insurer, homeowners, they all have what's called an underwriting department. And it's the responsibility of this underwriting department to rate the risk. And when they are rating the risk, their job is to determine if the applicant for insurance is actually insurable. And what the underwriter does is asks two questions. The first question, is the risk insurable? And the second question, can we insure this person using the coverage that this company has and the guidelines that this company has? Once the underwriter has answered those two questions, it brings them to a third question. And that question is, at what rate? How much are we going to charge this person? Now, they're going to ask, are we going to charge this person our normal standard rate? Or is this person in such great health condition, or are they in such a low risk area that we can give them what's called a preferred rate? Or are they in lousy health? Is their house located in an area that's probably going to cause their house to slide off the side of the hill? And that be the case, they're going to charge them extra. Well, I've got to tell you, folks, underwriters do not approach these considerations lightly. They can't, by law. The insurance industry in the state of California is a highly regulated industry, and this industry must comply with a complex set of state laws and regulations which are aggressively enforced by the California Department of Insurance. So, what is this thing called adverse selection? Well, by definition, it's the tendency of poorer risks to seek insurance. Let me give you an example. People that live near rivers that constantly overflow their banks are more inclined to purchase flood insurance than people who live up in the mountains. Uninsured people are more inclined to purchase individual health insurance when they suspect they may have developed symptoms of a major illness. Or they're going to want to purchase dental insurance when they suspect a root canal is in their near future. Now, to give you a very personal example, over the years, I've become an insulin-dependent diabetic. And I'm at the point in my life that for the last 7 years, I've become reliant on an insulin pump. Since going on the pump, my blood sugars have been finally, remarkably well under control. But the 23 years prior to going on the pump, taking as many as 6 insulin shots per day had me in a brittle diabetic condition, which caused non-reversible damage to various organs. As a result of my personal medical history, both life and health insurance underwriters consider me a risk. You bet. Okay? I am what is called an adverse selection when it comes to health insurance and life insurance. The net result? Well, as cute as I am, I cannot purchase standard individual life insurance, and I cannot purchase standard individual health insurance. Now, I'm not telling you this about me and my diabetes for the reason of, oh, poor me. I'm telling you about my diabetes only as an example of me being an adverse selection when it comes to individual life insurance and individual health insurance underwriting, to help you understand what that term adverse selection means. Now, in your particular case, simply being blind cannot eliminate you from consideration for any kind of insurance. If there are contributory health considerations that cause the blindness, or health considerations as a result of your blindness, then those factors could become an underwriting issue. But merely being blind as a standalone condition is not an adverse selection and is not, by law, a defensible reason to refuse or deny or cancel insurance coverage in the state of California. 34 states have enacted laws or regulations intended to prohibit discrimination against the blind in insurance, including prohibitions on refusing to sell life and health insurance to blind people, and laws prohibiting higher rates for this coverage based solely on blindness. California law specifically states that blindness itself is not a reason to deny or rate up a person for life insurance, health insurance, disability insurance, homeowner insurance, or other types of insurance that are readily available to any other person throughout the state of California. If you've run into problems with an insurance company when applying for insurance, you have a right under California law to know why you have been denied the insurance coverage. And I would encourage you to speak with the agent you dealt with and have the agent obtain in writing the rationale the underwriter used in evaluating your application. If the agent is reluctant to work for you, contact the insurance company. You have that right. If you don't get the information you need, geez, folks, contact the California Department of Insurance. That's what they're there for. And they're glad to be a service. Now, when I first spoke with Gene Lozano about the privilege of coming and talking with you today, Gene told me that some folks had mentioned to him being refused homeowner insurance because they have a working dog that was considered a vicious animal. Well, now I am here to put the kibosh on that rumor. You know, there are a lot of rumors that float around. And these are ugly, nasty, old wives' tales. Okay? It's like the rumor that you can get pregnant by sitting on a toilet. That ain't true. Well, let me tell you about this vicious dog rumor. I, in preparation for today, got in touch with several insurance company underwriters, and I asked 52 insurance company underwriters this exact same question, and I got the exact same answer. The question was about a German Shepherd working guide dog for the blind. Do you consider a German Shepherd working guide dog for the blind a vicious animal? 52 insurance company underwriters said to me, "Are you kidding me? That's a working guide dog. It's not a pet."
Wow, that's great.
So your working dog is not a pet in the eyes of an insurance company. They are not considered vicious animals because they are highly trained working dogs. You can't be refused homeowner insurance because you have a working dog. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Okay? Now, the insurance industry loves to keep statistics, and there are tons and tons of statistics about dogs and dog bites and this and that. And rather than bore you with all the numbers that the insurance companies and the insurance industry thrives on, let me assure you, no one is going to turn you down because you have a working guide dog. I have to ask myself this question. Is the insurance market for the blind consumer underserved? And, you know, you look at yourselves and you realize that the insurance companies put together these elaborate marketing campaigns to appeal to and then hopefully capture various segments of the population. There are comprehensive marketing programs addressing women, seniors, the Latino market, the Asian markets, for example. However, to my knowledge, there are no insurers that have specifically addressed the opportunity that exists in serving the visually impaired. Summarily, insurance agents and brokers will often specialize in certain segments of the market because perhaps the agent is Latino, or the agent is Latin, is Asian, and understands and appreciates the customs and the heritage of his or her background. I believe that there might have been some hesitancy on your part as a consumer to apply for insurance for various reasons, perhaps some valid and some that might not be as valid. You know, for all the years that I have been an insurance professional, I have never once seen on an application for insurance, not on a life insurance app, not on a health insurance app, not on a disability, not on a homeowner, and not on an auto insurance app, the question, is the applicant blind? I've never seen that. It doesn't matter. And it makes me want to ask you the question of why are you not being served fully if you're not? Are you not asking for the insurance? Are you not demanding that someone serve you? I have to ask that question. Unfortunately, the insurance companies don't directly market to you as aggressively as they do to other segments of the population throughout the country. Shame on them. So, you know, as far as agents are concerned, I think that many of them have not taken the time to discover that you are not any different from anyone else, except that you're visually impaired. Now, I'm not any different from anyone else, except that I'm diabetic. And the man sitting next to me is no different than anyone else, except he has blue eyes. And the lady sitting over there is no different from anyone else, except she's wearing a pink blouse. I mean, we're not any different from anybody else. Your needs and wants are the same needs and wants as any other person's. You need to plan for the future. You need to plan for your retirement. You need to plan for your health care costs, and you need to plan for your children's education. You may want to either purchase a home or refinance your existing home. You might want to arrange funding for your business, or you might want to set up a living trust and do estate planning to make some sense out of those burdensome estate taxes. And you might need to plan for your final expenses, to name just a few. All of us have those very same wants and those very same needs. So my advice, go out and find a professional, and we're out there, that you can be comfortable working with, who will take the time to help you identify your needs, help you develop your plan, help you protect and grow your assets, and help you realize your dreams. Now, just a little quick story. Back in the 1800s, an Italian businessman who was also an economist and a botanist named Vilfredo Pareto discovered a consistent operating model that is still used today. His theorem was that 80% of the world's wealth and land was controlled by 20% of the world's population. This theory, originally called the Pareto Principle, is now known as the 80-20 rule. Although it's over 100 years old, the 80-20 principle is often experienced and discussed by many in the sales and marketing profession as they attempt to manage their sales and marketing processes. What we've done in my organization is kind of massaged that a little bit and taken that 80-20 principle and flipped it around, and we call it consequence management. Because everything we do and don't do has a consequence. Consequence management is a business method used to track and adjust successes in order to manage the consequences which affect the ability to be of service to other people. And in our daily life, we don't consider ourselves as a seller of stuff. Rather, we consider ourselves the protector of our client. A lot of companies will market anything that sells. Oftentimes, an insurance marketer's job is to sell financial products, just like the cigarette manufacturer's job is to sell cigarettes. It's not legally their job to manufacture something that's good for people. But we think that our job is to insulate our clients from the garbage that gets manufactured. We recognize the garbage and we protect you from it. Tomorrow, we're going to be available to you in the La Jolla room from 9 to 11 for one-on-one conversation. And we're going to have with us an expert on Medicare Part D, everybody's confusion factor. We're also going to have an attorney that is an expert in living trusts and wills to talk and be available to you about that topic. And my partner and I will be here tomorrow to answer any questions that you might have that you want to ask us in a more intimate, private, one-on-one, or small group setting rather than in this large room today, because you've got a busy agenda for the rest of the day and not a lot of time to answer all of the questions that you might have. But we do have a couple of minutes to answer a few questions from the audience this afternoon.
Okay, we're going to take just one question. I know Connie has been standing at the mic for a long time, and since we're up, okay, two questions, and that we're just going to have to do it. This is just a great presentation.
Mr. Chairman, Connie Gill, I was refused, when I applied for long-term care insurance, I was refused a discount, not because I'm blind, but because I do not drive a car.
Wow.
Now, I'm sure there are a lot of sighted people who do not drive cars. I don't understand that one.
Well, I don't know that the insurance company expects you to drive yourself to the hospital. The reason they refuse the discount is because you don't drive?
Exactly. Do you want to go to the mic?
That sounds a little on the strange side to me, Connie. That sounds very, very flimsy to me.
Hi, this is Jerry Consler. I appreciate your comments. There were some rumblings a few years ago about insurance companies wanting to perform genetic testing to determine if people had non-visible diseases, late-onset disorders like Huntington's chorea. But there was also some talk about people who might have a predisposition for retinal degenerative disorders and so forth. My question is, can an insurance company under any circumstances require genetic testing to detect these types of preconditions?
Well, first of all, insurance companies are not doctors. and they are not scientists, so they're not going to grab you and throw you into a laboratory someplace. You know, insurance companies will, in fact, be interested in any scientific research that is, in fact, done, but they do not require you to submit to that type of research or that type of testing. They cannot. They cannot.
All right, thank you. We have one more question. Gil?
Yep.
You're the last questioner.
Thank you. Gil Johnson here. It has been said for a long time in the employment arena by employers that my insurance broker won't let me hire you because our insurance rates won't cover you or they'll be increased. Now, a lot of us did research and found that that wasn't, in fact, true. But I'm wondering, have you heard that, or is there any laws that prohibit that, or what's the actuarial say?
Well, if I was an employer and I was attempting to hire you, Gil, to drive a truck, then it probably would be pretty accurate. Unless Sebastian gets this truck that can drive itself on the road pretty quickly. But if I was going to hire you for a position that you were absolutely 100% capable of doing, then, you know, there's nothing that would stop me from hiring you. Now, obviously, you're not capable of flying an airplane. So United Airlines probably is not going to consider hiring you to pilot their 747. But you certainly have a whole basketful of employable skills that any employer could consider you for. The it's not going to raise an employer's rates.
Where that question came up, though, was particularly in industry, machine shops, where people who didn't understand blindness felt that the area being cluttered or moving equipment, I might be able to do the machine work right, but not get through the factory. And I'm just wondering, is it still on the opinion of the underwriter or the employer, or are there any kind of laws that would protect that?
The employer is 100% free to hire you if, in your opinion, you can competently, professionally perform the job duties and you can safely maneuver in the workplace, the employer is 100% free to offer you the job and employ you.
And it won't adversely affect the insurance rates?
No. I have never seen a question on any insurance application, is this person blind? I have never seen on a workers' comp application, do you have any blind employees? I've never seen that. Well, you know, I'm only 59 years old, okay? And I've been in the business for, you know, more than an hour, I promise.
All right. Thank you very much. This has been a great presentation. Please, everyone, avail yourself of Dominic and Stonewitter's availability tomorrow. This is a great offer that they've provided to us, so take advantage of it. And we're now going to get on to our next topic, accessible pedestrian signals. I won't reintroduce Linda. I will reintroduce, and they can decide who's going to go first and second. I will introduce our second panelist. We're thrilled to have our guest here. We'll hear from him again tonight. One of my colleagues on the ACB board and the president of ACB of Maryland, just an outstanding guy, and one you will be thrilled to hear from, Pat Sheehan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the cheering in the back of the room. Thank you. You'll get your check in the mail. Probably. It's great to be here, and I'm looking forward to chatting with you about accessible pedestrian signals and also this evening. I'm looking forward to that, too. I want to sort of set the stage and let you know where we are in Maryland, where we came from, and where we are right now. And hopefully we'll be able to share some of our successes with you. Back in 2002, we had, like everybody else, been trying like the Dickens to get accessible pedestrian signals installed in the state of Maryland. I think at that time we had about, let's say, 10 or 12 intersections in the entire state that had accessible pedestrian signals. We were really working hard. Our folks from the State Highway Administration, where a lot of the signals were being requested on state highways, they had put together a bunch of hoops that we needed to jump through. They had asked us about intersection design. They had wanted us to help them rate intersections for difficulty as far as being able to cross the intersections. To complicate matters further, we were dealing with the National Federation of the Blind, so we had a fairly large task force of ACB, NFB, State Highway, Maryland Department of Transportation officials, traffic engineers, all in one room, trying to negotiate and get the work done. So it took us a year or so to get the policies and procedures in place. And we jumped through, and I have to give Al Pietrolungo a lot of credit because he was on this task force. It was one of the task force that I happened to miss, thank God. But he jumped through every single hoop that we were given. And he was, and not only that, but as a trained investigator, he kept all the emails. He kept a running record of what had been promised, when it had been promised, and who promised it. And so by 2004, and I'm rough on the dates, I don't have them precise, but by 2004, ACB of Maryland was pretty fed up with our little paltry 10 or 15 intersections that we had these APSs installed. And rather than do the structured negotiation thing, we sued the Maryland Department of the Department of Transportation, because the Maryland Department of Transportation had not installed these APSs in the intersections that we had asked for, that we had the documentation that we had jumped through all their hoops, and that they had promised to do. They were just doing foot dragging, and we all know how that can be. It takes time. I think it was June of 2005, we had about 25 or so, maybe 30 intersections that we wanted to have APSs installed. I think it was kind of a modest request. They came back to us in June of 2005 and they said, you know, we really believe in APSs. Maryland Department of Transportation said this. We believe in them. We want to do 95 intersections. We said, wow, that's pretty amazing. I don't know why we jumped up from 6 to 95, but we were pretty happy. So we jumped at it. A month later, in July of 2005, we get this amazing letter, and I have copies of this letter here. I have 25 copies, and certainly we can make more if people want it. An amazing letter from the Federal Highway Administration, which comes back and sort of explains why Maryland jumped at the chance, or State Highways said, we'll do 95 intersections. And this letter basically states that intersections are designated under the ADA as facilities. And as facilities under the ADA, they need to be made accessible. And that includes the information in those intersections. So it's very clearly stated by the Federal Highway Administration that the State Highway Administration in Maryland was going against the ADA, in violation of the ADA. And so they need to come up with a plan, which they've been working on now, and they need to make sure that their intersections are accessible under the ADA, and that includes APSs. So now we're in the process of working with the State Highway Administration in the state of Maryland to equip 1,250 intersections with APSs. The letter that we have here, and I've got copies of this, applies just as much in Maryland as it does to you. So we've been working with them now, even with the NFB in the room, State Highway Administration, Maryland Department of Transportation stands up there and says, the installation of APS in the state of Maryland is non-negotiable. This is going to happen. By the end of the year, we'll have 70 more intersections installed with APSs. We've been using Polara. Thank you very much. Polaris, they've been great. As a matter of fact, I had the pleasure Monday of meeting John McGaffey, who's the president of Polara, has come to Maryland to look at how we're doing our installations, to talk about the configuration of the signals, to look at pole placement and how the signals are going to be configured so that the maximum information is there. And so we're getting a lot of attention, and we really appreciate Polara. We appreciate the hardware that they have. We certainly are thrilled in the state of Maryland with the decision of the Federal Highway Administration. We definitely want to share that decision with you. I think it's been printed in the Braille Forum. We have sent copies of this letter out through the Internet. We have shared it in about 6 or 8 states. We certainly would be happy to work with anybody to talk about, now we're at the stage of how are the signals going to be configured? What do we want them to say? I learned on Monday that these signals can also incorporate countdown timers. I was not aware of that. So they can incorporate that. So I think that's a big deal. So it's a nice place to be. It's great that we have people in the state of Maryland like Charlie Crawford, who started this whole project.
Oh, really?
L. Peter Lungo, who had the tenacity when he was being lied to and pushed around by Maryland Department of Transportation to keep accurate records. And now it's up to me and other people to make sure that we get the installation of these signals done properly. Thank you.
That is great. And we will certainly make sure that those copies of those letters are distributed. I know I've got to bring a couple back home to Gene, who's dying to get his hands on that copy.
We've got about 3 rings of APSs circling Johnson Street. Yeah.
All right, let's come back closer to home now, or in fact to home, and ask Linda Dardarian to resume.
So what we've been working on is APS in San Francisco, and we includes the CCB, the local San Francisco chapter, the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired, and the Independent Living Resource Center of San Francisco. And the reason why San Francisco was selected for the initial effort was sort of similar to Maryland, but maybe even a little bit worse if you can get worse than 6
than
or
Maryland.
8. There, San Francisco had a total of 1 audible pedestrian signal. 1. Not even an entire intersection, just 1 signal. And the signal was outside of the, or on the corner of the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium, and it was installed for a technology conference. It was not installed to benefit the community. So we started the structured negotiations process with San Francisco a couple of years ago, and we're working towards getting a settlement agreement with them, hopefully by the end of this year or very early next year. And we, sort of similar to the issues that Pat has been discussing with Maryland, we have had a pilot testing of Polara and Novak's APS, audible pedestrian signals in San Francisco at six pilot locations. And the city and the experts that we've hired to participate in the process and members of the community participated in the testing and evaluation of the different types of APS that are available on the market. And the conclusion was that Polara is the has the best features and the most comprehensive features at this time. So what we are working to, we've also worked out what the actual features of the APS will include. And what an APS is, if you don't know already, is a push-button integrated device that's on the pole near the, adjacent to the crosswalk, that gives information about pedestrian timing in a non-visual manner. And the non-visual manner can either be audible or vibrotactile. They APS include audible tones, speech messages, and vibrating surfaces. Specifically, there's a push-button locator tone that emits from the signal box, so that approaching pedestrians will know where the push button is, so that they can activate it before crossing the crosswalk. The push-button locator tone is a tick. The push-button locator tone, or also when a pedestrian activates or pushes the button, light emits from the signal from the signal box to tell the to alert the pedestrian that the button has been pushed, and also a different tone emits than the locator tone. The APS has an audible walk indication, which, depending on the placement of the poles at the intersection, can be either a rapid ticking sound that alerts you that it's safe to cross or that it's time to begin crossing the crosswalk, or a speech message. And the speech message has basically is the following. It says the street name. The walk sign is on to cross the street name. So there's a reconfirmation of where you're located and what crosswalk you are crossing. The APS also has a tactile arrow that is aligned with the direction of the crosswalk and has the street name in Braille and in large print on the box. They also have an automatic volume adjustment that goes up or down depending on ambient sound. And there's also a feature where if the pedestrian pushes the push button in for more than a second, more information is provided, such as if it's not time to cross the crosswalk, then the push button information will tell you wait to cross, the name of the street and the name of the crossing. Also, other information that can be contained in the push-button information message would include details on unusual intersection configuration. So we've worked out those features with the City and County of San Francisco already. We've also been working on technical specifications about pole placement, the distance from between the APS and the corner, volume control and settings, and the circumstances under which a rapid tick is to be used for the cross indication versus an actual speech message. We also have worked out the details of a prioritization tool that the city will use when there are more citizen requests for APS than can be implemented at any particular time. And we're in the process of getting the city's commitment to an actual schedule for installing APS in San Francisco over the next 3 years. The city is committed to getting substantial funding for installation of APS. Like the state of Maryland, they have come to recognize that this is a priority and it's a requirement, and they are very committed to making sure that there is that the process is in place and that it works and that there will be installation of APS throughout the city in the near future. They're also committed to not only getting tapping their own funding sources, but working with other governmental agencies and granting authorities to get additional funding for APS installations. They're working with, believe it or not, Caltrans to make sure that Caltrans participates in the costs of funding APS at Caltrans intersections within the city. The schedule that will be worked out with the city includes installing APS at locations that are on the CCB and Lighthouse request list. Those will take priority over any other intersections. After the CCB and Lighthouse request list the intersections on their request lists are done, then they will take and install other public requested intersections. So, we've gotten their attention. We've become their priority, which is fantastic. They're also committed to making ready all new and upgraded intersections for APS installations. They've made a commitment to maintain the existing APS and make sure that the new installations are properly maintained, and they're going to have a process for citizens to make complaints and to track their complaints about maintenance malfunctions at APSs. They've committed to hiring an APS consultant who is a certified expert in orientation and mobility issues and APS to continue working with the city on this issue throughout the term of the agreement. And sort of one of our favorite things of all is that the city is committing to having semi-annual meetings with CCB representatives from the community to participate in evaluating the APS program throughout the term of the agreement, to talk about issues regarding the ones that have already been installed throughout the term of the agreement, ones that should be priority for future installations, possible additional funding sources, and pretty much any other issue regarding APS that the community wants to bring to the city's attention. If there are representatives of other governmental agencies that the community thinks should be involved in the process, the city will make their best efforts to bring those other parties into these meetings with CCB representatives. And the city is also committed to having community training on how to use APS at the Lighthouse. They're going to have a Polara signal at the Lighthouse so people can test it out and get familiar with it before they start crossing the streets. The city's also going to provide a lot of detailed reporting to the CCB throughout the term of the agreement on all these issues. So we're hoping that we can get this settlement agreement with the city announced in the next few months. Again, because it's a bureaucracy, things take more time than one would hope. But once this settlement agreement is announced and public, we will circulate it, make it available on the CCB website, and hopefully have it for further distribution. And what we're thinking is that we could use this agreement as a model to approach other municipalities and have the, you know, the, it would be ready for the members to use directly as well to approach your local governmental representatives on the APS issue.
Thanks.
Good. All right. Thank you very much. Do we have any time for questions? I think we do. Audible pedestrian signal.
Accessible pedestrian. Audible.
Accessible, excuse me.
I think it started
it's either audible
I'm
really, or accessible.
It's really late for me.
It's either or both, yeah,
either
right?
Both. No, not anymore. Not anymore. No, it's accessible.
Not anymore. Now it's accessible. It used to be audible, now it's accessible.
Just put them in, right? Yeah.
That's okay. We have our first questioner almost.
Yeah, I shouldn't have sat way in the back. It takes me a long time to get up here. Gil Johnson. Patrick, I'm wondering, the negotiations you've had have been with the department that operates state highway intersections. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was directly. That's how the complaint was filed.
Okay. Do you think that that agreement then will give you leverage over municipal-controlled intersection?
Absolutely. There's no question. We have used this agreement to extend this because, you know, an intersection is an intersection, and it applies. We have it applying to state highways, but we also have used it all throughout the state of Maryland. And as soon as they see the agreement, you know, they're putting these APSs in, particularly, and Linda is correct, and I should have said this myself, we have a installation schedule over the next 10 years to get 1,250 put in. The reason why is because that's how long it's going to take State Highway Administration to hit every intersection. Every intersection they hit that they're going to reconstruct, and they do this on a regular basis, they're going to wire for accessibility so that the real cost of the accessibility is putting the wiring in underground, mm-hmm. having the pole placement, making sure that's correct. Once that is done, it's just a matter of slapping the APS in. So if you're working in an area, whether it's state highway, whether it's county or whatever, getting and finding out when they're going to be hitting a particular intersection is key, and that's what the traffic engineers know.
Great.
The other thing is we need to make sure that Polara is manufacturing enough of these and making and providing the maintenance services for keeping them working. So, you know, this is sort of an opportunity for Polara to expand their business greatly. They should be giving you a lot of credit.
Sure, I think.
I definitely want to get a copy of that letter, Pat.
I have them here, yeah.
Thank
so.
You.
Can we get some electronically?
Yes, absolutely. I'll take some names. Anybody who wants to come up afterwards, I can just get my email cranking. And we've done this a lot already, and we're happy to. What's that? We can do that. Yeah.
And the ACB.
And I think it is on the ACB. I'd have to double check that. I did talk to Erlene about that, but let me double check.
Is there an actual written agreement too that's posted or that we could get on the website too?
I have the letter from the Federal Highway Administration with that. Yeah.
Great.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, Jeff.
Go ahead.
Linda, I'd like to introduce myself. My name's Rob Cook, and I'm a CCB member for a long time. I've been outside the area for about 6 years, but I come to CCB conventions, and I brought an interesting piece to CCB here recently. It's called Blind Signs. They're detectable directional guide strips, and I think you've heard of us through Don Brown. Mm-hmm. I wanted to introduce myself here before CCB while I'm here in the room because I just walked in. I've been at my table. I only have one kind of question because I've kind of been to the background of the issues, thanks to Don and CCB. To what level are unmarked or unsignalized intersections being addressed through this whole process? And, of course, I'm interested because blind signs is a very inexpensive, detectable, and directional guidance system that's in the midst of research at Western Michigan University.
We actually haven't been addressing unsignalized intersections at all. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't.
That's what I was hoping to hear.
But it probably wouldn't be in this agreement because this agreement's going to be so soon. But that doesn't mean that we couldn't explore this issue.
No, we live through controversy as an out-of-the-arena complement to ADA PROACT mechanisms like APSs, APDs, detectable warnings, but that's the significant factor that we hold, which is we're not statutorily mandated or required or negated. We have the opportunity to be a complement and directionality to the systems. That's why I was really interested. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks for introducing yourself.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, hearing none, I want to thank both of our panelists. This is a great job that you've both done. And be sure and come up here at the end, and we can distribute the copies of these letters that from the Federal Highway Administration. Well, I'm going to start the introduction while she's making her way up here. Oh, you are here. You know, it's a fitting way to end the day that we look back and learn a little about our roots as members of the California Council of the Blind, because if we don't learn from whence we came and what our core values are, then we can't do as good a job in ensuring that we protect our future and make us the best organization that we can be. And there's no one in this organization, absolutely no one, I would say in this whole country, but there's certainly no one in this state better to do that than our past president, Catherine Skivers. Kathy?
Gee, thank you so much. You know, I saw my place in the agenda, and I saw all the wonderful speakers, and I thought, gee, I wonder if I should offer a prize to get people to stay. But it seems like you're doing pretty well. Anyway, it's always a pleasure for me to talk to you, especially if we're talking about CCB. It's been a kind of a life work for me. I've had two families, my own at home and this family. Of course, this one's a lot bigger, and I'm glad I don't have to feed you all because it's tough enough with the family I've got. Anyway, I always love to talk about us, and I was thinking, I think by the end of this little presentation we'll know whether I do better when I come on to talk to you, when I get to be a banquet speaker and didn't know it, or when I have time to plan it out. And I figured it out already. It's better when I didn't know it happened. I wrote a lot of things here I'm not going to have enough time for, and, you know, on and on. Anyway, first I want to introduce you to the committee or tell you who they are, and then I'll tell you about what's happening, what we're doing. First, there's Roger Peterson. He's our techie. Everybody knows, I'm sure not. He's just a tremendous lot of help. And Bernice Kandarian. Bernice keeps me on the straight and narrow. Few of you have heard about Chris Gray. He's president of the American Council. He's a hard worker on this. And Al Gill, who has a bio and a 50-year history. And I told him before I came on, if I run out of gas, I'm going to say, okay, Al, you're going to finish this out. He didn't find that too pleasing. Don Queen isn't with us, but he certainly knows a lot of history, and he's been around and written a lot of resolutions. Joe Smith was quite active in the vending stand committee, and so he's there. Jeff combined the two committees, and then there's Gussie Morgan. She's here, and she has an extra job. She's a member of the committee. Also, a policy minister. And her job is heavy because she's got to pray that I get to stick around long enough to finish this thing out. And time's moving up on me. I don't know that I'd be around long enough to write a book of my own, you know, just my own self. We're going to do the history. But, gee, I know a lot of stuff that I could put in a book that would sell great guns about things that we can't put in this history. But I think you'd find it very interesting. You know, we are a wonderful organization. We've done a lot. We've been pioneers. There isn't anybody, I don't think any blind person, if they're around or visually impaired, that hasn't been impacted by some help and something is done by the organized blind. I'd like to hear about that. That would really deserve a big page because I don't think they're there. Of course. On October 6, 1934, 29 people met in the Jade Room in the Fresno Hotel in the city of Fresno. And the idea was talk about forming a California Council for the Blind, and we were for the blind. And the idea was thought up by Mrs. Kathleen Michael. She was chief of the Division of the Department of Social Welfare then, Department for the Blind. And she had invited some blind people to come, and the one who represented the blind people there was a man named Dr. Newell Perry. One more time, spelled N-E-W-E-L. He was director of advanced studies, and he had traveled up and down California for 10 years, finding his former students and encouraging them to get interested in this, and they were already working in behalf of the blind. And he got him to come to this meeting. And the doctor had a way of kind of getting things to happen when he wanted them to. He had people like Jacobus Tenbrook and Perry Sundquist, who later himself was chief of the Vision for the Blind for a long, long time. And they came, and we'll make a long story shorter and cut out several of my pages by saying the people who were there, who were sighted, had met earlier to try to decide what would be best for us. And they were going to have another meeting another time to do a constitution. Well, you know, Chick Tenbrook was not a constitutional lawyer for nothing. And he got in there and with doctor's help. And it just happened there were a few more blind people than sighted. And a couple of sighted people voted with us. And when the day finished, we had a new constitution. We had all kinds of bylaws in order. And we had a brand new president of that group. And guess who that was? That was Dr. Newell Perry. And he served from that time until he retired in 1953. This man was known throughout the nation. Before he got out here and got readers for us, he stopped off on his way back from Europe, where he got a lot of degrees, and he stopped in New York, and he convinced the legislature there to get the first reader fund they ever had. I think it even preceded ours. And he knew and felt that the thing we had to do was have rehabilitation services, and education and any kind of service, assistance from the state or the county to let us function with food and so on. He felt that the way to do this, to get to be independent and get a job, was going to school and learning and be the best you could be in whatever you did. It was easier in those days to form an organization because he had students in his classes at the School for the Blind, and they got reading, writing, arithmetic, and legislation. And so when they graduated, they knew, you know, you better show up at Doctors County Club meetings. You better be there. And if you're not, you better have a darn good reason. The council through the years has put in as many as 15 bills a year, and sometimes 30. We have a pamphlet in our things that we've, where two or three of the things were introduced by another group, and then the other 27 were ours, and we did a good job at getting them passed. We had a lot in those days because blind aid had to be dealt with. We had it before Social Security came in. When they started out early on in 1919, they thought a blind person might be getting, could get $150 a year. Then pretty soon they raised that to $400. The trouble was the counties administered it, and by 1928 there were only 735 people in this state getting assistance. So we got an initiative introduced, and what happened was that initiative went on the ballot in this state, and it passed by the largest margin ever to that time, 5-1. For 72 years we've been out there. We started many organizations. We asked to get some material for this history of ours. We've been collecting it for years, and George Fogarty provided us, while he was still with us, 8 tapes of his feeling about how the history was. We also have a 50-year history that we almost didn't find. We found it, and it will be an appendix. Is it an appendix, Roger, or is it appendices? I always have trouble with appendicitis and things. I don't know. Anyway, it's going to be there. We're not going to change it. It is Perry Sundquist's version of what he saw the first 50 years of California to be. But he did not give the women the recognition that they deserve because they did a lot of work. And interestingly enough, the council was founded. Then in 40, they founded the National Federation. California had a big hand in doing that. And, of course, the leaders for at least 27 years were from California, Dr. Tenbrook and others after him. And then we had, as George said, I was troubled a little bit about how to report some of this or how to do the history. And so I thought, let's go to different people and have them tell us what they think the most important thing was that happened while they were there, or people that they knew. And George said the 50-year history is very nice, it's factual, but it's not all there. And he said it has no personality. And he said, now if you're going to do this thing, do it and see that it has a personality. Well, you know, he also said another thing. I was reading his tape again the other day, one of them, and he said, there have been wonderful things. We've had some good things in this organization, and we've had some bad things, some sad things. He said, if you're going to really do the history, it must do both. Well, the council has had some splitting occasions. In 1959, we had a problem where we all had a disagreement, and basically the leadership that had been the leadership, including Dr. Perry, resigned in February of 1959, and another group who were more toward Dr. Tenbrook went ahead and continued CCB, while many of us went and formed the Associated Blind of California, the first affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. Well, when they decided to go nationally, what do you think happened? The CCB old members, who were now the American Council members, went over and we helped form the American Council of the Blind. Later on down the road, the Federation had a little difficulty with California Council of the Blind again. So in 1978, I believe, was the year they left them. And then they were on their own for a while until they got involved with the American Council of the Blind, and we merged in 1985. So what's going to happen is that we're going to have the equivalent on the organization that was the first American Council affiliate. Interestingly enough, the California Council of Blind had no female president until 1997, when some upstart came in here and was president from 1997 to 2002. That was me. And interestingly enough, the first two presidents of the first American Council affiliate were women. The first one was Juliet Esterly, Bent Esterly, and I was the second one. And so I have been a president in the American Council affiliate and this one. Jeff Tom is a president here and on the board of directors of the American Council. Bob Acosta was president here on the board of the American Council. And Bob Campbell was an Associated Blind of California president, and also, when we merged, the president of this organization. Now, that's going to be a formidable task to get all these people recognized, get bios on them, get them in. We've had some wonderful help. Frances Menino sent me a letter at my request telling us what she knows about Tony and how she felt about Tony. And I think it's such a wonderful thing. It's just a few barrel pages, but I tell you, I think it's so from the heart. I think it belongs in a history. She got the spirit of the man as well as tell us, did any of you know that Tony and a lady named Jean Norris are the people who founded the Twin Vision books, where the people could read to their children and Braille on one side, print on the other? Did any of you know that? I had never found that out until Francis told us. We also asked Bob Acosta for a tape. He sent it. It's great. And only one thing made me mad, though. He was telling about when he went to get a job to be a school teacher in Los Angeles at the high school, and he was the first teacher to teach sighted children in a high school with a blind teacher, and he went to get this job, and this lady interviewed him, and he knew right off the bat she didn't want him, and he had his dog with him, and this dog was sitting there, and she would ask Bob some very questions, Garrity says, to kind of upset him or do whatever she could to rile him, and dog kept getting up and down, and he thought, what's wrong with this dog? She never does this. And pretty soon, and she said, well, I don't think we could have you in the classroom. How are you going to control the children and the dog? And Bob said, I don't think that'll be a problem. But still, this dog kept getting up and down. And when he stood up to leave, she said, and this is what made me mad, "Well, I guess you're right. The dog will get along with the children." I was pushing him with my foot to see if he would be annoyed. And I said, I thought Bob showed a lot of restraint. Been me, I wouldn't have gotten the job because I think I'd have hit her. But anyhow, we're going to run out of time here, and we've done a lot of firsts. We were first in all the things that you heard earlier. The American Council of the Blind First affiliate had a deal with an insurance company, Continental Casualty Company. We managed to get all the long-term rates and everything they had for the same as anybody else with no rate up in rates at all. And that was quite a thing in that time. We have continued to do first. You heard about all the ATMs. I am very proud that our own Barbara Rhodes has really fought hard and got the talking prescription bottles in Kaiser in California. What we've done is we've had lawyers, we've had doctors, and I sat down to try to put down, and it's hard to find out what we haven't had. We have engineers nowadays and graphics and all these technology people, which I always leave to Roger because everybody knows I don't know much about it. And we've had contractors and builders, and I don't, how much time do we have, Jeff?
Oh, go ahead.
No, I don't plan to stay here all night. But you know, we have first, like we were the first people to recognize that there was no AIDS education on HIV. There was none for blind people, deaf people, or any of the populations, the hemophiliacs, the development disabled, and we formed the first consortium for that. And we're always pretty proud of that, and that has to be in the history. It had a several-fold purpose. We were pretty low on money back in 1997. When we started this, we found out that we could charge a portion of a grant off for our rent. We could hire blind people to work part-time, and we had about six altogether at different times. And it was really great. We got the benefit of educating people, too. But I want to tell you that I am concerned, and I wanted to be with you again because I'm worried about we get people in here, and we've done wonderfully well getting members, but I'm concerned that we are not paying enough attention to the legislation. We're not paying enough attention to what happens to us. You might say, well, in 70 years, you've done it all, but we haven't. Some of our people are getting letters from Medi-Cal saying that they're now going to take any insurance you have and whatever at the time of your death, and whatever you've got is going to pay off whatever services you've gotten from Medi-Cal and other things. To me, to Elmer Chapson and others, and maybe to Al, you will remember, that sounds like the old lien law to me. I think we need to be watching for that. We're losing a lot, and I had some things that we've lost, but we're not going to have time to do it. But I do want to tell you about the one and only assemblyman we have had. If any of you are taking political science, pay attention. This gentleman was Ernest Crowley, and he became an assemblyman in 1928 and served to his death in 1952. He was one of Dr. Perry's boys. He was born in Suisun, and he's lost his sight at the age of about 13. He had gotten out of the sixth grade and went hunting. It was a thing, I guess, for kids to go hunting. There was a shotgun blast, and he lost his sight. And he went to the school for the blind, and he met Dr. Perry, and all the kids took him under their wing. When you go to the school for the blind, they keep you from being homesick. They do various and sundry things to you to keep your mind off of it. But in any case, he went there, and that school was not accredited at the time, so he had to go to Fairfield to the high school. And the principal said he never had a blind student before, but he was sure they could get him in there if they could figure out how to teach him. And so Ernest said, well, he could get a reader. And oh, the principal said, no, he didn't think so, never had any of those. So he called Dr. Perry, like everybody did in those days who got in trouble. And after Doctor came and talked to him up there to the principal, he was so impressed with Doctor that Ernest got enrolled in school immediately in high school and graduated next year as valedictorian of his class. He entered the University of California. He wanted to be a lawyer, and his folks didn't think much of it. His mom was more worried about how he'd eat than she was of how he was going to going to get any education, and his father thought it was kind of useless to spend money on a blind guy getting an education anyway. What he was going to do with it? But being good parents, they gave him $40 a month for his expenses. He spent $30 on his room and board, and the other $10 went for his laundry, other expenses, and his girlfriend. His girlfriend turned out to be a reader that he knew back home, and they eventually got married. And he went in to the legislature, and this is what I want to tell you, and one of the reasons I wanted to profile him today is because he had some of the philosophy that we have, and with your help, we're going to continue it. He was in a county that was 5,000 Democrats and 7,500 Republicans. And he had lost a bid for a justice of the peace a few years before. But a friend came in and told him that they thought that he ought to run for the assembly. They needed a candidate, and they thought he should be it. Well, he really wasn't too interested, but he thought it might be interesting. And he started. The filing fee in those days, you ought to listen up when you pay your taxes nowadays. The filing fee for that kind of thing was $25. A friend gave him $10. He got the rest. His brother-in-law did it. He was a printer, so he, in good faith, gave him some printed things that he could pass 3,500 campaign letters out. And friends and relatives contributed labor and a little money to get stationery stamps and addressing. So when he won the primary, his dad thought that was pretty good, and he gave him $100, and that was his campaign fund. In any case, he went, and he was running against a very prominent family member and a man with a lot of money, and he said, well, I'm not going to win this thing, so talk about technology. He went to bed before midnight. He wouldn't even turn the radio on. About midnight, he found out that he had won by 1,186 votes.
Wow.
And he had gone door to door meeting people and shaking hands because that's all he could afford. Now when they come and shake your hand, you better see what's in it because we have passed constitutional amendments. We did other things, but Ernest believed that in spite of everything, the whole world is not going to be lost when you become blind. And he would tell people who were blind, just newly blind, and we got a lot of those, don't get impatient. You'll gradually advance yourself, and eventually you'll get along as well as anyone does. And he really took advantage of himself. He would carry bills for us, and he did, but he told the doctor, don't ever bring me garbage. Bring something we really have to have. But one anecdote I think is priceless. He was in the assembly when there was a tremendous electrical storm in Sacramento, and all the lights went out. And the assembly was in session. And there was a lot of confusion, a lot of banging around. And finally, somebody in a loud voice said, where in the world is Crowley? He's used to going around in the dark. Have him get us out of here. And he did. He gathered them all up and he got them out. I'm going to wind this up by saying something to you. I know we have a lot of special interest groups, and I don't think anybody can beat you in this organization for the kinds of programs you special interest people put on. We can be proud of everything we do. We've been proud of everything we've done. But there's a lot more to be done. We have signs that they want to take more things away than we've already lost, and we don't have time to go into that today. But you know, I try never to make a promise to you, and you just got to take hold. I'm not going to be around here forever, and people like me, we have an octogenarian group, and we got enough people to form an affiliate, Jeff. But our motto, I think, or whatever that thing is, you know, the kind of little saying, we've got one. We've all agreed already on what our slogan's going to be. Getting old ain't for sissies. But in any case, what I want to say to you is that some of you, there's leadership in this organization. I see it every day. And we have some wonderful things that we're going to try to pass on. Maybe Mike Keithley will let us put some archives, occasionally a little article in the about our history. But like I said, I never make a promise to you. And when I leave this world, we don't know when that's going to be. But you know, none of us know where you go. But I always like to do what I say I'm going to do. And I tell you, if some of you guys don't get out here and get busy and keep this organization going, I'll find a way to haunt you. And I'll come back and do it. So with that in mind, if you don't want to get on my list, please endeavor to build your affiliates, build your chapters, hang in here and keep this being the greatest organization there is anywhere. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Catherine. What a great history we have, and we really look forward to hearing more and more about it as the years go on. Okay, we're going to have lots of, we're running a little late. I think we're going to put off door prizes until tonight and further sessions. So, for the moment, we are adjourned.